My name's Roger Leavers. I moved to Godmanchester in 1989. I became a volunteer with the local small museum here. I seem to find myself becoming a sort of local specialist on World War II history. My first book, Godmanchester Stirling, which is called Stirling to Essen, that book sold worldwide over 3,500 copies, and that's the story of a bomber crew that crashed here in 1942. And then a little later, when I started to do more research into the town, I found some documents outlining the activities at Farm Hall. And whilst most of the memories that people, or the stories that people have got of Farm Hall, are about the German nuclear scientists, which of course is worldwide known, I am actually managed to find a lot of documentation about the Hall's, Farm Hall's history prior to it being taken over by the German scientists, when it operated as a spy hall from the summer of 1942 through to the summer of 45, when the scientists came in. So the book actually
got me just... Roger, can you say something about your work before you retired? Because obviously, you know, it'd be interesting to hear what sort of person it is that suddenly gets into this, well, not suddenly, but slowly gets into becoming a bit of a historian.
Well, I've always been interested in history from school, really. But I was in sales before, as a sales manager, both sort of regionally and nationally. I've always enjoyed, obviously, researching things and putting presentations together, etc. And I do a selected number of talks, which are very popular in the area. And really, it was just a case of finding these amazing stories that hadn't come to light and no one had found, no one had written about, apart from, obviously, the scientists. And then being able to piece those together into, I suppose, a book which tells human stories. That seems to be my speciality, be able to tell the human side of wartime.
Yeah, a lot of this stuff, of course, as people die, is disappearing in memory. Can you just tell us a bit about where Godmanchester is and about this Stirling story?
Well, Godmanchester is on the River Ouse, the Great Ouse, just about a mile from Huntingdon south. And yeah, it's a beautiful little Roman town. The history goes way back to Roman times. It then has fantastic Elizabethan history and Victorian history. It's a gorgeous place on a lovely river. It's well worth a day out, actually, to have a walk round and enjoy it. And the Stirling to Essen thing came about out of nowhere, really. It was an email that came into the town that got passed to me, because, as I say, I was interested in the Second World War. And it was from a gentleman who owned the squadron leader's sports car from the 1930s. And he was trying to find out more about the crash. The squadron leader who owned his car in the 30s had been killed in the crash. And that was basically the germ from which the book came. I decided I would try to find the families of the crew and try and put the whole thing together as a story of their lives and their service. And one by one, I managed to uncover them, or they found me, I found them. And yeah, the story came together of this fantastic crew and the ones who came and went from that crew and what became of them all. It has connections to the Battle of Britain through the captain's best friend, who was a Battle of Britain pilot. It connects with India through his first co-pilot, who was a Sikh, one of only 24 Indians that flew with the RAF. And there's even a connection through the bomb aimer and his girlfriend to the Holocaust in the Czech Republic, Czechoslovakia at the time. So the book really contains all sorts of history of the war and how really you see how everything intertwines. It's not just a straight line. Everywhere is connected up through these various events in the book.
Sounds like a very human story. What is a Stirling and what was the connection with Godmanchester?
Well, the short Stirling was the first four-engine bomber that was used by the RAF. It was sort of rushed into production because they needed to increase the bomb loads they could take to Germany to increase the amount of damage they could obviously do. The Wellingtons weren't able to do that. There was too many losses for too small a bomb load. So the Stirling was rushed through. The short Stirling served a very vital role to the RAF and Bomber Command before the introduction of the Halifaxes and the Lancasters, of course, who were far more famous. The Stirling, there's not a single Stirling left anywhere in the world. They were all scrapped at the end of the war, which I think is an absolute tragedy, considering the part it played. Once it turned out and was replaced in the front line squadrons, it then became a tug pilot. So it was basically tugging gliders across the channel. It was used for dropping supplies into Europe, and it was also used on secret agent drops and supply drops to the resistance in France, Norway, wherever. So it still played a vital role even after it came out of the front line. This aircraft was the one, as I say, that crashed at Godmanchester on the 11th of April 42. So we've just remembered the crew again. And it made its way back from Essen, where it had been badly damaged when it was coned by searchlights. They got it back to almost to Alconbury to land. With its undercarriage down and ready to land, it was told to go around because there was an aircraft on the runway that shouldn't have been there. And sadly, on that one more circuit they did, they lost both starboard engines and it crashed to the east of Godmanchester. So there is a memorial now, which we placed there in 2017. Made of Stirling granite from the land that basically Stirling Castle is actually sitting on. So that's quite an appropriate rock to use.
So what about Farm Hall? When did you first get interested in that, and what is it?
Well, Farm Hall is a very large private residence built in the 1500s. It was originally built for the Recorder of Huntingdonshire back in the 1700s, as I said. During the war, it was requisitioned in the summer of 1942. It's always been known about the scientists. That's world famous. That's not new information, although I cover it in the book so that people who can understand what happened in its totality. But the hall was actually requisitioned from a family in the summer of 1942 by the RAF under the Wartime Powers Act. And a gentleman called Wing Commander Courtly Naismith Shaw, who was known to his friends as Pink Gin Percy, came over from Bletchley Park and set it up as an SIS operation. And he started to set it up, and it became a transit point for agents travelling up from London through Godmanchester and Farm Hall and then on to RAF Tempsford, which, of course, was a in brackets secret airfield, where agents were then transported into Europe, all nationalities. Courtly ran the hall for a couple of years, but he was never a guy to hang around very long. So almost as soon as he was in there, he was looking to train a number two up. And he found that guy, a guy called Wing Commander Bruce Bonsey at Huntingdon, working for Pathfinder House. And he brought him in as his number two. Well, I should say he ambushed him in the local pub, actually. But that's what happened. Courtly was that sort of a guy. He never hung around very long. He stayed, he trained Bonzo up, stayed there a little while. And then Bonzo, Bruce Bonsey, took over the hall. And he basically then operated the agents and the dropping of the agents through Tempsford right up to when the nuclear scientists arrived. So the nuclear scientists, he mentions those in his notes, that he was there when they arrived. And he was said it was manic because all these microphones were being fitted into the hall. And that's when, obviously, he then left the hall, and the listening team and the agents that were in the secret operatives that were there, British intelligence, came in and started to control the whole thing, if you like.
OK, so what year was it that these nuclear scientists started turning up?
They came over in July 1945, so they'd already been...
Oh, right, so this is literally after the war. So what was going on at the hall during the war? Was this just a sort of staging post where was there training going on, this sort of thing?
We've got no proof that training was going on. It would seem that the training was happening elsewhere. I do know that things like target practice were carried out, but that could well have been... shooting was carried out because maybe their drop had been delayed or something had happened. What we do know is that the hall was fully equipped to look after the agents. So anything they required that they brought up with London, if anything was missing from their kit, that could be replaced. So if they decided in London they didn't want an L pill, but a lethal pill, but then they changed their mind coming up, Godmanchester would have all the equipment there to be able to replace that. So they were able to look after them, feed them, keep them in these grounds, which were guarded. Obviously, there were sentries there. And these guys and ladies, because quite a few ladies went through, they would stay there. They'd be wined and dined and looked after whilst Courtly and Bruce Bonsey were liaising with Tempsford regarding weather conditions, what aircraft would need to be used, what time they needed to be there, etc. So it was a very key role that the hall played between London and Tempsford.
It sounds to me, reading between the lines of what you're saying here, that there's still a bit of a secrecy associated with it.
I've got locals who often tuck their nose and say they knew exactly what was going on there, or their parents did, but I doubt that because it was always guarded. I think the only time the locals got confused and were a bit wondering about things was when initially it was staffed by RAF officers with Wrens reporting to them. And the locals, I think, found that rather weird, and it did raise some attention. But to cure that, of course, they removed the Wrens and put WAFs in, and then everybody was very happy. There are still a lot of secrets to come out of Farm Hall. Certainly getting access to documentation as to all the agents that pass through is very difficult to find. We've managed to, or I've managed to discover probably 7 or 8 that went through. We've had 2 recently that we've managed to identify who are Belgian. We still know there's information hidden away. But stuff does come out from time to time. We do find, I mean, only a few weeks ago, I have sent a new photograph at the back of the hall of some WAFs and a couple of RAF gentlemen sat there sort of enjoying the sunshine. So things still come out.
Okay, so at the end of the war, there had been a race on, hadn't there? And this was talked about a lot by R.V. Jones in his book from the 1970s, I think, or 80s. He was the chief scientific officer for Winston Churchill, and during the war, and for the War Cabinet, he talked about the absolute fear that the highest ups, and they weren't sharing this with the public, of course, but that the Germans had developed nuclear weapons of some sort, and that one might be on the end of a V2 rocket and land on London. So they were quite clearly concerned about the extent to which the Germans were developing nuclear weapons. And if you look at Frisch and Piles, the people that the couple of scientists that first apparently came up with, officially anyway, came up with the idea of a nuclear bomb at Birmingham Nuffield University, I think 1940 or 41, that they were both Eastern Europeans. So the Germans had also split the atom in Berlin before the war. So they were quite rightly concerned that this was a race the Germans might win.
I totally agree there was, but I think there's a number of things here which possibly, in my opinion, this is the problem with Operation Epsilon and the German nuclear scientists, is it's always a matter of opinion. Looking at what the scientists were saying when they were locked up in the hall, and you look at the transcripts, they talk about the bomb, etc., or making a bomb, but it's they're mostly just relaxed and they're trying to talk about fission, nuclear fission. Some of them were old school Germans. In other words, these were from Teutonic families that went back hundreds of years. They, in my opinion, and looking at the Farm Hall transcripts, you can see that they weren't interested in a bomb. They didn't want a bomb. They didn't think it was actually a good idea to have a bomb. You know, who are you going to threaten with it? London, Paris, Amsterdam, and what's the point? You know, you're going to use it as a bargaining tool. You know, if you wipe out London, they're going to come and wipe us out. So there was a lot of arguments about that. There's also a good degree of evidence that the more senior officers, the more senior scientists, the ones who were the most respected and the slightly older ones, almost deliberately got their calculations wrong. It would appear that they were giving information out when people were trying to get funding for their research to make a bomb. These scientists were saying, well, actually, his figures are wrong. You can't make a bomb unless you have this amount of uranium, or you've got this, or you've got that. And that turns out in the transcripts. You see this when Hiroshima, they are in one of the rooms in Godmanchester when they hear of Hiroshima. You can see then how this suddenly escalates from the fact that they're not really getting on particularly well with some of the more senior, well, more the, some we say, diehard Nazi scientists. It then becomes very aggressive, because these scientists are saying, well, how can they have made it? The Americans are fools. How can they make a bomb? They're 10 years behind us. But of course, they then start to find out just how much resources were being thrown by the Americans at creating this bomb. And the Germans didn't have those resources. They may have had those at the start of the war, possibly. But as the war progressed and it twisted and turned back to come towards them, and, you know, D-Day happened and they started to lose ground in Russia and the North Africa, Hitler, I think, became far more interested in sudden terror weapons, V1s, V2s, rocket-powered fighter planes, all these sort of things that he thought could you know, cause terror and bring the war maybe a little bit back to them. I don't believe in my own mind that the Germans, I think some of them wanted to build a bomb. I have no doubts in my mind, and it's quite clear some wanted to build a bomb, but those diehard Nazis, it appears, were blocked by others trying to squeeze down their resources and their access to money, etc. And so I think there was a definite plan by some to block the whole operation, to make sure it didn't happen. There's also a number there who were actually trying to create a nuclear engine. So not a bomb at all, but they wanted to create an engine that would give a ship or maybe a plane or a tank endless energy, something they could harness to power vehicles and ships and planes rather than just a bomb, which they didn't see as being something the Germans should really have.
Fantastic and fascinating dynamics at play in a situation like this, with these disparate characters all sitting in a room where they may know they're being bugged, or they may suspect it, they may not. And they're also maybe trying to sabotage the efforts of other scientists to actually make a bomb. Do we know if the recordings really reflect what they were actually thinking, or were they were trying to mislead anyone who might possibly be listening to them, or even to their colleagues there?
I think there was a lot of subterfuge and dynamics going on between the scientists themselves. There was quite clearly an animosity toward two or three of them who were diehard Nazis and who were determined to have tried to make a bomb in the early days. They didn't know they were being listened in on, that's for sure, because they actually mentioned that, you know, do you think we're being listened in on? And one of them says, no, they're not. They're not as sharp as the Gestapo ways. They're not as good as us. So they clearly didn't understand that they were being listened in on. That every room they had access to, including the garden, was bugged. So we could, I mean, they did a fantastic job, the British intelligence, to be able to bug all these rooms without them ever finding one in the 6 months that they were there. I think the dynamics between them are quite clear when you read it. I mean, the Farm Hall play, which did exceptionally well in London and went on tour, and in fact is coming to Huntingdon towards the end of July, you can see there how those dynamics work. So they didn't get on, all of them. They were speaking of a free mind. They didn't believe they were being recorded. As for the total Farm Hall transcripts, some of those transcripts were destroyed, unfortunately, at the end of the war, or the end of Operation Epsilon, because some of the conversations were seen as, you know, not being of any interest or any point, so they were scrapped. But we still get enough of the transcripts to be able to see the reactions between these scientists, how they clash, especially after, as I say, they announce the Hiroshima bomb, which is a pivotal moment in the transcripts, because that's where the shock that the Americans have done something that they couldn't. They call themselves idiots. You know, they say we're fools. Someone like the Americans beat us. So they're really insulted about this. But then, as I say, they see the amount of resources that the Americans threw at it, and they realize that there's no way they could ever have come up with those resources to have made a bomb themselves. So, yes, there's still people who believe they were close to a bomb. They made a bomb. But my impression from the transcripts is that, no, they were nowhere near it, and they probably stopped going in that direction probably around about 1942, when things started to turn against them.
Tell us something about these bugs, if you know. I mean, how do you have secret microphones in the garden? I mean, what have they done, hidden them in tulips or what?
They probably hung them in trees. I mean, when the microphones and the cables for the microphones weren't discovered till many, many years after the war. So it was a secret that continued for probably a few decades before somebody decided to do some work on the hall and suddenly came across all this wiring. And of course, then it's when, round about then, when Farm Hall and Operation Epsilon, which is the name of this operation, became public knowledge. So, yeah, I wish they'd got some of that cabling. It would be wonderful to have had some of it. But it was all scrapped and got rid of. But as I say, information still comes out of the family that currently own the house, and it is a family property. They're sort of saying, well, you know, one of these back rooms here was the listening place where the team of transcribers sat. I mean, these transcribers were obviously fluent in German. Some of them, I believe, were Jews who had come to Britain. And obviously, to be able to work on this was a certain degree of revenge for them. But it was always believed that that was actually happening in the hall or an annex of the hall. But actually, we know now from Bruce Bonce's information that actually it was in the stables across the road. So even the listening place was situated away from the hall across the road in a barn. So, yeah, it was well hidden. But they weren't, you know, this wasn't the first time or only time they did it. Trent Park near Cockfosters was also kitted out with microphones and also filled up with German generals that they'd captured. And they put them in there and they listened in on those as well to get an idea of how they were reacting as news of Germany and their retreat and their defeat started to come, because it gave them an idea of how it would be working in Germany, how the German generals who were still out there fighting would start to think about how things were going. The sad thing about Trent Park was that there was actually information on these tapes about genocide and war crimes. But because the British wanted to keep it secret, they were so good at this, those instances were never followed through. So even though we had these admittances on tape, they were never actually carried through to prosecutions, because we wanted to keep this ability to listen in secret. And clearly our British intelligence service were exceptionally good at it.
Well, there's an element of the Bletchley Park there, isn't it? Playing God. Which information will we release and which information will we not release? But look, you talked about a play. That sounds like, if people are interested in the story, well worth looking up.
Yeah, with the Oppenheimer explosion the other year, we actually had two Farm Hall plays come out. Farm Hall itself was launched. It has six of the scientists in it. The author just used six, the key six, if you like. And she wrote a play called Farm Hall. It launched in Jermyn Street Theatre, a very small theatre in London, and it sold out on its run very quickly. It then went on tour and did quite well on tour as well. It's not currently being run nationally, but our local drama club, and I've been to see them last week as they did their first read through, and they're exceptionally good. They're launching Farm Hall in Huntingdon. It's the closest venue we can get to Godmanchester. And that's going to be in an evening performance on the 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th of July. With a Saturday afternoon matinee as well. And my Godmanchester Sterling Fund, which raises money from book sales, has already supported and sponsored one of those plays, one of those evenings for them. And I'll also be selling the books in the foyer of the theatre to raise money for the theatre as well. So we're trying to support all those who are telling these great stories. The second play that came out was called Operation Epsilon, and that was at the Southwark Theatre. It was a far bigger production. It had all 10 scientists, but it also had a British officer in it, Rittner, who was the guy in charge of them. That was a more detailed portrayal of what happened at Farm Hall during that period. It was far more intense in many ways, because you had all 10 scientists there. And of course, you had the British officer who was both the scientist's friend and confidant, but also a man who would put them in their place if they forgot that they'd actually lost the war.
What's your personal review of the two plays, please?
Farm Hall, I thought, was exceptional. Great acting, great story. I would recommend that to anybody. The other one, funnily enough, I thought Operation Epsilon was, a far more deep dive into the story. But it didn't go any further than Southwark Playhouse, which I found was quite strange. It was a brilliant set, massive set. So obviously you couldn't do Farm Hall on that stage, and you couldn't do Operation Epsilon on the Farm Hall stage. Totally different beasts. But Operation Epsilon was a massive stage, and it was also had an upstairs to it as well. So there were like bedrooms up there and a study. So the play was always moving around. But I say the actual inclusion of a couple of the other scientists who were like the guy Gerlach, who loved gardening. He was absolutely addicted to gardening. And of course, Farm Hall has this huge garden at the back. So, I mean, his part in the Operation Epsilon play was in walking through with a pair of secateurs every now and again, saying he's pruned the roses or whatever, which was quite funny. But the inclusion of that British officer in the Operation Epsilon play was quite vital, because that was a superb role to play, both the friend and the confidant and someone who was could liaise and look after and calm these scientists. But as I say, a guy who, if they stepped out of line, would be very firmly reminded they'd lost the war, and if they cause any trouble, it's going to be rather bad for them. So, yeah, they're both good in their own way, but they both tell the story slightly differently.
Yeah. Shouldn't he have been a bit careful with his secateurs? He might have cut a few wires, mightn't he?
They never found the wires. That's the beauty of it. I mean, yeah, they'll be in the trees, you see. There's some very big trees out the back of that hall, and I'm sure that's where they were probably hidden.
Yeah, so if he started looking upwards, he might have had someone might have had a word with him. Anyway, can you just give us again the titles of your books and whereabouts people can get them?
Yeah, the best place to get them is probably direct from me, because if you do that, then I can make sure that a quarter of the sales is donated back out again to local and national causes like the play. Sterling to Essen, that's £13 paperback. The postage is P&P is about £3.50, something like that. And the Godmanchester at War is a hardback. That's £20. That covers not just Farm Hall, but the entire history of the towns during the war. So it also includes, I ought to say, the story of the V1 that was aimed at the hall in January 45, which very nearly took it out. So that's another story to read about. But it also contains lots of personal stories of children growing up, evacuee stories, Dad's Army, ARP, and the wonderful story of politics between Huntingdon and Godmanchester, who've never really got on particularly well, especially not during wartime. So it's quite got lots of laughs as well in it as well. And so that one's £20. Again, P&P is £4. If they want to contact me to purchase a signed copy, delighted to do so. Thank you. And I would, you can get me through my email address, which is Roger Leavers. You can, I'm sure, post that up. RogerLeavers@yahoo.co.uk. And if they email me there, I can organise a signed copy of those books for them.
I think we better spell that. That's Roger, L-E-I-V-E-R-S.
Yeah, R-O-G-E-R-L-E-I-V-E-R-S at yahoo.co.uk.
And have you got a website?
There is a website that backs up the first book. It's called The Godmanchester Sterling. And that actually is not of much use to people unless they've actually read the first book, because it's absolutely packed with new stories and photographs that I couldn't get in the first book. So that's a website best visited once you've bought the first book. I do have a Facebook page which is called The Godmanchester Sterling. It's got nearly 6,000 people following it. It's not any way, shape or form anything about me. It's stories, etc. So this week we've, for instance, been honouring a crew of an unarmed aircraft that was shot down by a German night fighter over our town on the 23rd, 24th of April 1944. And we've been honouring the crew this week, telling their stories. So there's lots of stuff on there. If any people want to join the Godmanchester Sterling Facebook page, they're more than welcome. We'd welcome on board.
Huntingdonshire historian, World War II speciality, Roger Leavers, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure, and thank you for the invite.